The Good, the Bad, and the Boucherian.
The Good, the Bad, and the Boucherian.
And folks, you're listening to The Good, the Bad, and the Boucherian.
The burden of inclusion is almost always placed on the minority. And you have to survive. Like, you really have to survive, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I went to a predominantly white school where everybody almost, I can't say don't quote me on this, but maybe almost 50%, 40 to 50% of the school would pay their full tuition. That's $70,000 a year, approximately.
No way.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, this, everybody can receive financial aid, but a very substantial, we need to research that or fact check that, but a substantial amount of students would pay full tuition. Of course, our challenges are different. Yeah, you still have
jobs. Are not knocking at your door. I thought that was the, what I told.
No, jobs
looking for
they,
you.
They do come looking for you, but you still interview and you can get rejected.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten rejected for when I was applying to my job. I applied to over 200 jobs before I got one. Yeah. I don't think you handed things on a silver platter. Of course, the name.
You aren't like, you know, in Kenya, you're told once you go to such schools, you're assured. So even though you go to interview, it'll be like, once they see MIT, it's a lie.
I mean, it's a lie. Of course, I can never say that I had a breeze in college. Never.
Really?
I can never say that. Mm-hmm. I had that. Not horrible. It was incredibly stressful. There's so many things. After going into grad school, there's so many things I did not know. There's even, I don't even know if this is TMI, but even your menstrual cycle is psychologically affected by the stress. It's irregular because...
Hey!
Yeah.
It's your boy Billy back at it with another episode. Hope you guys are keeping well, keeping safe amidst the pandemic, and things are going well on your side as they are on mine. Today, my guest in studio is Christabel Chimutai, a Jill of all trades. And so firstly, professionally, she studied at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, also known as MIT, where she studied electrical engineering and computer science for her undergrad and master's, and currently is working as a consultant and a software engineer at Keystone Strategy. And now she also says she's all things African, born and raised in Kenya, or do they say born and bred in Kenya, where she went to Moi Girls High School before moving to MIT, where she's been living for the past 6 years. And she considers herself an Afrofuturist for this, where, and she believes in the school of thought that Africa is the next IT place, the next big things. And she'll tell us some of the reasons she believes so. Even in this episode, she again says she's all things fun. She's an avid reader. She's incredibly curious and incredibly obsessed with understanding how the world is, as you'll see in this episode. As well, she loves to dance, salsa, bachata, and sometimes even pole dances. Loves cooking. And she says she was born for the skies, as nothing thrills her as much as traveling. And so... we'll listen to what Christabel has to say about us. I think when I tell the guests, I have very good quality guests. They sometimes doubt, but want to hear Christabel's story. So Christabel, tell us.
So what does Christabel really do?
I'm a consultant. I work in consulting, but that's a very broad term. So I'm a consultant. I work for a company called Keystone Strategy. I have a strong engineering background. So I studied electrical engineering and computer science for undergrad and graduate school, a master's. Graduated last year in September. So at Keystone, we use business, technology, and economics knowledge to help our clients solve strategy and IP problems primarily. So an example of some of the cases that we would work on is things like helping a company understand its market, market strategy, the competitive landscape, how to roll out a new product, etc. We also help with litigation, things to do with IP, so patents, trade secrets and trade secrets misappropriation, defining what privacy is. So we support those kinds of litigations or open markets and antitrust. Yeah. So that's a little bit about what I do. Talk more specifics if you need me to.
So let's start with, just tell me about little Christabel, where it all began for Christabel.
Little Christabel.
Yes.
As you what?
Yes, little Christabel, where it began for her. Did she ever know she'd be here? Was she ever
actually always ambitious?
Yes, so tell me about little Christabel.
So, I was born and raised in Kapsabit.
Mm-hmm.
Until I was almost 3 years old, and then we moved to Eldoret.
Mm-hmm.
Then I grew up there all my life. Went to primary school there, and then went to high school there before I moved to college in the US. Actually, I had even begun medical school in Moi before I moved here. So I did not, for the world of me, ever imagine that I would be where I am today, or that life would take me where I am. Also, I didn't, I don't think my path was very planned or very intentional or very, this is what's going to happen. Like, if things had worked out the way I wanted them to, I would probably be in University of Nairobi right now graduating. I would have graduated and I would be probably a physician in a hospital somewhere doing my internship right now. But, you know, things happened and now I'm here where I am. So little Christabel, what was she doing? Ah, I had a happy childhood. Ah, I was so
Tell
happy.
Me about it.
I was so happy. We used to do things like Kapsabit is very hilly and very beautiful and very wet also. So we do things like I would play. I was the youngest and I used to play with, I grew up on my mom's side of the family. So we'd do things like my grandmother had a nice like a fruit orchard-ish that was next to the river. So we would, when it rained, we would go and slide by the hill.
Mm-hmm.
On the clay soil,
uh-huh,
into the river. Okay, I vividly remember that, and we'd get so much. Our parents would give us so much shit for coming back home with dirty clothes. But we'd always just go. We pluck banana leaves, and then we sit and slide on the clay. Yeah. What other things do I remember from my childhood? I broke my arm climbing a tree. It was actually quite crazy. And then I was happy. I was just generally happy. Maybe I was an activist a bit.
How so?
I don't know. Like, I remember when one of my teachers really beat one of my friends, Alib Chapa, until she had a, or I don't know if your audience has non-Swahili speakers, but she got caned on her hand and she had a clot. So me told this girl, we have to go and report this teacher. And we went and reported this teacher to the head teacher, but little did we know that the teacher would come and beat us even more. Bro. Yeah, writing newsmakers. I used to write newsmakers because I used to be class monitor. What else did I do? Yeah, so I was happy. I was generally happy in at least primary school. In high school, it was a bit different because I was in a big school, public school, so a lot more people, lots more dynamics to deal with.
But tell me about those dynamics. I really want to know about those dynamics. Did you ever experience culture shock moving from your primary school to high school, or was it another day in the life? Was a public school really, you know, that was it traumatizing for you, or was it not?
I liked my. I mean, there's a lot they can work on, but it was generally nice. I don't think there was a huge culture shock. I first me When I graduated primary school, I didn't get the school I wanted. I wanted to go to Kenya High, but I was nearly to a Kapsabet Girls, and I really did not want to go to Kapsabet Girls. No offense to anyone who went to Kapsabet Girls. I really did not want to go to Kapsabet Girls. So what I did is I carried my primary school transcripts and I went to the principal of Moi Girls, and I told the principal of Moi Girls, please just give me a spot in your school.
Then you as an individual or you with your folks?
No, just me. I told my dad, please, can you take me to Moi Girls? I'm going to ask for a school for myself, because I just felt like I did not want to go to Kapsabet Girls, and also I just felt like my life prospects, not in a bad way, I just wanted, I was so scared. So I went and told the head teacher, just give me a school. I promise I will work hard and, you know, I'll make you proud or whatever, you know. And then she gave me a school. But when she did, I joined, I think during the time, Form 1 used to join in February.
Yeah.
By the time she could know whether or not there were spaces for people, was in around mid-March. Mm-hmm. So I joined very late, like almost 2 months into the semester, into the term already. I had a lot to catch up on when I got to school. I struggled a bit in my first year because, again, I was late. There was so many things I needed to learn about the school. I don't think I was in boarding school in primary school, but it was different because there were very few people in our boarding school, and we're also the first cohort in our boarding school. So it was very different to join an established system, you know? So I don't think there was culture shock. It was just a regular transition, life transition like any other. I was a bit surprised at the diversity of talent, let's say, or just people from all over the country. That one was quite shocking. I didn't expect that. No, I expected it, but nobody prepares you psychologically for it.
Mm-hmm. Do tell more about that.
No, still, because it was a national school. Moi Girls is a national school. So they had probably admitted people from everywhere in Kenya, and also admitted people from all walks of life, you know?
Yeah. So,
my first encounter, actually having a conversation with a Muslim, was in Moi Girls, because I went to a small school in primary, so it was different. Yeah, so there was small things like that. I didn't even know prefects had not so much power, but kind of prefects could like move mountains in high school, you know.
Yeah.
The small things like that. New people had accents, but just listening to everybody's accent was a different thing. Like, I didn't know things like people from coast were allowed to leave the day before at night so that they could arrive in coast the following day in the morning. You know, the small things like that are just in my high school, in my primary school were different because most of the people came from Eldoret or just around.
And even with the accents, I remember recording an episode and science I was telling me in high school, it was in in Nyanza province around Kisumu.
Yeah.
So for them, there's obviously even at the school at Mispo nationally, there'd obviously be a certain percentage of people coming from that area,
in the Nyanza area.
And so for her, for them, you know, there's obviously that Luo accent. I've forgotten what they call it.
Yeah.
And so there'd be prejudices against people like that. So they'd prefer people who have the quote unquote polished English.
But is that the whole of Kenya, though? That's the whole of Kenya. Don't blame it on that high school only.
I'm asking you, did you experience it in high school?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's everywhere. Anyone who can, you know, roll there, you know, have a fancy accent or...
Hint, hint.
You know, just the cool kids. Like, if that's run, it's just, you know, modern day colonization. Anyone who could speak better was generally more accepted in the society, you know, or had social points.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that just runs everywhere. Atta, guys, even guys who, guys and girls who would speak good English would. Just the dynamics, like those are the ones who are attractive,
or
who are more, like even in funkies, would get a lot more attention. You know, this is, yeah, that one is, yeah, modern decolonization.
But about that, do you think it's as easy to unlearn that?
Oh, no, I don't think it's easy to unlearn that at all. Like, I think it's incredibly difficult to unlearn years and years of socialization that we are indoctrinated all the way from nursery school, when we are told you cannot speak Swahili when you go to school. Nakuna disc. Did you have that? Okay, we had a disc.
No.
Did you
have
a disc? Oh my God, we had a disc. Billy, we used to go to school and they'll tell us, if you say any word in Kiswahili, you have to wear a bone, a rotten bone on your neck. Imagine, they have actually stringed a bone onto Andy White and it stings. Alafu, you have to find somebody else who has spoken Kiswahili and give them the disc. Small things like that. If you, if everyone who, you know, spoke, probably why even people change their accents, but that's a whole other story.
We're here for that story. But we'll get to that when we reach you.
We can have another podcast about modern day colonization. You know, that one is a topic. We can even have take-home material. You know those podcasts that have accompaniment PDF is attached at the top.
At the bottom.
You're true. We even have assignments. But you know, so I think it's a, we have, generally, we really have a long way to go. Even to, from how we speak to how we view ourselves to what is considered attractive or not attractive, what is considered professional and what professional, how to wear out your hair. All of those things are, even our dressing, everything is in Europe, inspired by the West.
So, yeah.
Yeah. But it trickles down, definitely, to everybody in childhood. Yeah. But story for another day. I feel like we could have a very long
podcast on that. Let's
plan that. We now have another one. We're to invite panelists. Me, I know people who can help us talk about decolonizing the African mind.
Bet.
Yeah,
after this, we're setting a date for that with your panelists.
Perfect.
But obviously, even when you get to now, how you're working now, and ask you about the whole corporate world and wearing out your hair and dressing, and you contrasting that with how us, because now you said we are being affected by Western culture, but now you are in the West, and so are you being in Rome and having to do what the Romans do? And when you come to Kenya, is it easy for you to quote unquote decolonize your mind, or are you now used to that way? So when you come to Kenya, you know, that's a whole thing I'll ask you later. But now tell me about how you finished high school.
Okay, no, I feel like you want to answer both questions. you should not have dangled that.
Okay, just feel free to answer it now.
Okay, very quickly. It's impossible to not go, to go to Rome and not do what the Romans do. Of course, I've been here for almost, 7 years now. Of course, that culture is going to affect me. Of course, my words are going to sound different. But that's not from a place of, okay, I'm abandoning my culture. After staying here a while, I'm realizing it's incredibly difficult to walk into a room and have people always say, huh, what did you just say? If I could just say water and have my water on the table, I'll do it to just reduce the of prejudice that I'm facing. If you walk into a career fair and everybody is judging you simply because of your accent and assuming that you're not qualified for the job, of course, I'm going to have to context switch. I mean, everybody does it. Look at Trevor Noah. Anytime he's speaking with like a Nigerian accent, if he's talking to Africans, like he always switches up the vibe. So context switches.
Nothing about it.
Yeah. Like if you really, really think about it, what we should define it as is context switching, and not necessarily people are changing their accents or are remodeling themselves. It's just it's incredibly difficult to integrate into a society, to a majority that is completely oblivious to the challenges of being a minority, right? It's always the burden of inclusion is almost always placed on the minority. And you have to survive. Like, you really have to survive, you know? Like, I went to a predominantly white school where everybody almost, I can't say don't quote me on this, but maybe almost 50%, 40 to 50% of the school would pay their full tuition. That's $70,000 a year, approximately.
No way.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, this, everybody can receive financial aid, but a very substantial, we need to research that or fact check that, but a substantial amount of students would pay full tuition. Of course, our challenges are different. And again, and you have to interact with these people in class. You have to, you know, integrate into that society. So of course you have to context switch. Okay, separately. The small things that I still worry about, like I still worry about how I wear out my hair. I still worry about my accent and how I walk into a room and what people, the prejudices that people have. I still worry about how I dress, although the West is a lot more progressive, for instance, than how I've found Kenya to be. Like, nobody will punish me so much for what I wear than they would in Kenya.
Mm.
Like, also my hair. If you see my hair, I might have blonde locks. Somebody like me would get a lot of, like, if I was working in consulting in Kenya, I would not. So, like, it's not the traditional, exactly, you see?
Yeah.
But we're getting, as tech grows and as big tech also penetrates into sub-Saharan Africa, the culture is going to significantly shift. Because if you look at, for instance, the West and look at how people used to dress back in the day when finance was, not that finance is not a thing right now, but the big ballers were, you know, bankers and, you know, everybody would be dressing in nice suits and, like, the vibe was very professional, business professional, right? But right now, tech is now a thing, and you have people like Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates who don't really care about what they're wearing, you know? They just want to get pants and can go to work. It doesn't really matter. So that has significantly shifted the culture, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so separately. So then now we can talk about the other one. The other question was me after high school. Oh, I finished high school. Oh,
before you go back, now that we're here, I have some. Yeah.
Okay.
Now that we're here.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. So, have you heard this quote about no one ever achieves freedom? Okay, I don't know the right quote, but it's something along the lines of no one achieves freedom from the colonizer, quote unquote, by standing up to what the colonizers think is right. Just saying that we need to.
I think the quote is, I don't know if it's the one, but dismantle the master's house using the master's tools.
Yes. Ah, thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Of course, you can't dismantle the master's house using the master's tools, but also you have to pick your battles, honestly. I think everybody can collectively change the world, but you also have to know the limits for what you're able to do. Like, for instance, I can't think of when one thing I really struggled with was, for instance, during the pandemic when the George Floyd protests were going on. I couldn't just casually go and protest in the streets because of the implications that it could potentially have on me. I could lose my status. I was not completely vexed by what happened. It's not that I did not want to protest. It's just that I chose different avenues, right? So I 100% believe you cannot dismantle the master's house using the master's tools, but you have to start somewhere also. Like, you have to pick your battles. Like, change takes a long time, and choosing your avenue for change without significantly hurting yourself. Like, we don't have to romanticize change and make it this thing that you have to sacrifice your life. And
your life.
You know, it does not work like that. You have to be able to stand on your own 2 feet first before you're able to change others, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that sometimes mean the things that we're doing, like, oh, I context switch when I'm at work. Like, if you hear my accent when I'm at work, it probably sounds different, but it's not.
Give us a hint.
Ah,
give us a trailer.
But no, you can't, you get what I'm saying. But you see now, so I think it's just important to pick the right battles. Doesn't mean don't fight for change. Also, that's controversial. Many people think otherwise. This could be a conversation about, okay, radicalization versus the Marxism, but not Marxism. What's his name? Luther King Jr. versus the other one. The other one who was a peacekeeper. I don't remember his name. I know his face, but yeah. There's those two during the civil rights movement, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
even with that, obviously, I think at the end of the day, you're black. That's the first thing that will speak. So if you decide to, that's already a struggle on its own. So you can't again decide to speak more struggles.
Exactly. You have to choose your battles wisely. It doesn't just mean, okay, don't live obliviously. And it just means it's okay to be selfish. Sometimes, it's okay to pick, it's okay to not protest on the streets. It's okay to use other avenues. Like, because honestly, what will I do now? I have to go and start college again. I can never come back to the US. Other countries will be like, yo, you lost your status. You can't travel to our country anymore. Like, you see the implications. Like, is that just protesting in the name of, does that take away my heart from the cause, from the true cause of, actually, Black Lives Matter? Not really. But again, whole conversation we could have about, again, what change means, how do you propel change forward?
Should let me write that down.
You take the radical route or the peaceable route, you know, diplomacy, a whole other conversation, like how much is conforming too much, you know? Again, it's a fine line.
I just like how you said, context really matters at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Because for me, if I was protesting in Kenya, there would be such implications vis-a-vis you would be protesting there. And in a presentation, I was just being told the difference between Africans and Black people. I was just like, wow, where does this end? You know? And even speaking again, you talked about even now as the big tech companies come to the Sub-Sahara. It was recent when I think Google.
Yeah, that's big. That's
is that all for you really coming back now?
I'm coming back. I want to live and settle in.
That's what they all say. That's what they all say.
I know. Hold me to this. I need to go back to school though. Once I've gone back to school, I'll definitely. It's a complicated question. That question of coming back, what exactly does coming back mean?
Relocating?
Does that mean you completely uproot yourself from all the other places in the world? Not necessarily, you know? Does coming back abandon your whole life, the life that you have built, in an entirely different foreign country? You know, not necessarily. I think coming back for the modern day or the contemporary African is it's a complicated mess, and we need that's again a whole other podcast, Billy.
This is your sign. It's on a podcast. You see, this is your sign.
But you see, so the concept of just coming back does not necessarily mean, okay, leave your job, move back and completely dissociate yourself from the West. And I think that's how people think about coming back,
you know? Yes, exactly.
I don't think for the contemporary African or the modern day globalized African who has had a privilege to travel the world or be somebody like me, you know, who's I think I'm incredibly privileged and I have to acknowledge that, given the schools that I went and the exposure that I have, I don't think I can fully set root forever in one place.
So what would coming back to you mean?
It would mean maybe having how I think about, of course I have a life here. I could think about owning property here. I could think about having a career here that still allows me to work abroad. I could think about, if for instance, one thing I want to do in the future is teach.
Does that really mean,
I want to be a teacher, 100%. I want to be a teacher. Does that mean I can teach and I can still teach in a university or a research facility in somewhere in Sub-Saharan Africa, but that doesn't mean I can't also teach in the West. That doesn't also mean I can't also live in another country, you know?
Mm-hmm.
the concept of coming back is we need to dissociate that with what coming back should mean is reinvesting or resources. It could be money, it could be your time, it could be your brain back to the market. Yeah, that's my definition of what coming back is.
Wow, that's actually very crazy. That I love that perspective. I've actually not thought of that in that way.
Because it's impossible. Like, you have built a life here. Life, and your whole community is here. You probably have to reintegrate, and and time is running out. Like, your challenges when you're okay, for instance, in my early 30s will be so different from the challenges I'm facing now. So we need to just change that mindset of thinking that coming back means abandon your whole life in the West and then move back, you know.
I think that is also related to lack of exposure, where for some of us who haven't had those privileges to go then experience that life, we just wonder, why would you guys abandon us? You know, like, why would you guys not want to come back? We feel like you guys should come back and should do this and live your whole life. We don't even think about it, that you guys have actually built a life there. Well, we feel like it's a temporal thing where you guys have just gone for a short time, then you're coming back.
But that's also interesting how... Should anyone feel entitled to you and your time in your life like that, you know? Like, who gets to lay claim? And I think it also affects, again, us in the context of quote-unquote survivor's guilt. Okay, you have survived, or you are kind of what is considered quote-unquote making it, which is also a secret conversation. But does that mean that you have to, be a philanthropist all your life simply because, like, you know, like, who gets to say, okay, because you, who gets to define for you what you do with your time? Like, why does society judge people harshly, people who choose themselves? Like, do you really, can you actually say, we want you to come back and we want you to reinvest in that? What if I don't want to? Like, is that a bad thing? What's so bad about that? There's a whole case for it's okay to just leave and leave. You never come back.
There's
all the negatives of but you can't, again, who lays claim to the African diaspora and what the contemporary African diaspora can do with itself?
I think it also just ties back to, even as African parents, using their children as investments. So I know if I'm sending you there...
Using their children as investments.
Your child is an investment plan. I'm giving you the good education. I'm expecting benefits. I saw this whole conversation. I was just like, that's actually very interesting how parents would do they love their children really unconditionally?
What even is unconditional?
Exactly. What even is unconditional?
Yep. Or I'll take care of you so that you can take care of me when I'm old.
Yes.
Or you just started working, build me a house.
You think I'm just telling everyone my child is in MIT to suffer as my child prospers? That something has to give.
That in creates this whole black tax mentality that destroys black people, completely destroys black people.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you experienced it? Tell me about it.
No, I mean, this whole expectation of you lazima utume kitu nyumbani, or you have to send something home every other time, or you have to support XYZ. And I fully acknowledge that not everybody is privileged enough, and you just having your check, your $65 check at the end of the week, is that's rent for somebody, right? But what it does is just it creates so much undue stress on students in the diaspora in the name of I need to work, I need to send money home, and I need to support XYZ. You grow up so fast. In Kenya, you would be able to do that when you have started working. That means when you're 23, 24,
25. Right? Even at least when you're starting working, people don't have that much pressure.
Exactly. But in the West, it's like when you go, everybody thinks all of a sudden money grows on trees and you have money.
And you have some, you have to have money. Yeah. How don't you, Christabel? How don't you have money?
Where does the money come from? You know, also people think you're earning in dollars and then they convert it into shillings and then think you're spending money in shillings. You're not spending money in shillings. You're spending your money in dollars.
Mm.
You really are spending your money in dollars. So I don't want to discredit the fact that not everybody is privileged enough to just, okay, I can just not work at school. But I want to also acknowledge that that time you spend doing that library job at work study or doing that desk job or doing that arranging things in the house or for a dorm or moving things for somebody, that time could have been sent, could have been spent building memorable college experiences, mm-hmm. could have been making friends. It could have been spent, you know, exploring your campus. It could have been spent studying. It actually takes away from your college experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you, at a moment, if you ask me, right, yeah, mm-hmm. it does. It really, really does. If you ask me right now why I don't have friends, too many friends from college, it's because I was doing all of these things. So I was always working. If I'm not in my house doing my homework, I'm somewhere at a library job or I'm at another job on campus, you know?
Mm-hmm.
At what point do I just live? There's no mm-hmm. time. It just, it's like, again, you grow up so fast and all of a sudden you have all of these responsibilities and you are already supporting people. Like, we need to let these children breathe.
Yes.
Yeah.
And but the issue is,
yeah, acknowledging that it's just not everybody is privileged like that.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. Another issue is when you start supporting, people now become entitled to you supporting. It has to be a continuous thing.
Yeah, it does not stop.
Yeah.
Nobody ever teaches us how to say no.
Mm.
Yeah, it's just, if you say no, you're a bad person.
Like, yeah.
Let me suffer, you know?
And but when Kenya economy is taking us badly, you're, you know.
Yeah. But just let the child be a child.
Mm.
Yeah, just let the child be a child. And everybody who has probably gone through the diaspora and doesn't necessarily come from a middle to low class background will tell you the same thing, that it does take away from your college experiences. It really, really does.
So for us, at least you're telling us, we should let you people be children. You guys are not, because even me, when a certain friend of mine who came back to Kenya recently, and so obviously he's meeting his friends in Kenya, whatnot. And he's telling me how it's like, it's a very sad state of affairs where when he goes out with his friends, it's somewhat unspoken that he's supposed to cater for the bill. So he went out with these guys and these guys ordered everything.
That's me all the time.
Baby. Really? Tell me about it.
I don't know why people are so entitled to you and your time and your money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You go somewhere, everybody orders, and then the check comes. Nobody looks at the check. Everybody wants you to be the one to do it. And nobody even offers to do that.
Yeah. And that tells you beforehand that, yeah, by the way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I feel that person. Where? I really feel them.
Mifungwe support group.
At size. Hi, kabisa. Vile kunenda. The way it's looking.
But how do you deal with that? How does it? Does it make you feel like these friends are not as authentic as they should be?
Yeah.
Or do you understand? Uh-huh.
There's nothing like understanding. There's nothing like understanding. If you don't know me like that, you can't be that entitled to my money.
Mm-hmm.
The only people who can be entitled like that are home, my family. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, but mm-hmm. I just think that's so crass. Just get a grip. Don't live a life. Live within your means.
Yeah.
Yeah, just like, just, it's just so crass. It's so horrible.
Mm.
It's so horrible. Yeah.
Because when you hear Christabel is coming to Kenya, we've already planned all the trips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because you know she's definitely not coming here broke.
Another stereotype we perpetrate, actually, that you have a lot of money.
Most
people are not like wealthy. If you really think about it, it's just because for sure, if you translate $3,000 that you get from your scholarship into Kenyan shillings, that's 300K. Of course, that gives you some runway. But are you really, really wealthy? We need to stop pretending and flashing a lifestyle that is just, it's not it. If you actually come here and visit Africans in their homes, not everybody is living great lives. It's not, of course, not everybody is living great lives in the sense that, oh, because you can do a bad job. Not that this is a bad job, but you can do a job like, I don't know, say washing toilets. It's not a bad job, it's a job, but okay, let's, I really don't like to use this example, but
just use it. It's a safe space.
Yeah, it's a safe space. Safe space until your podcast blows up and then all of a sudden I'm on Twitter.
There's no bad publicity.
But you see, you can do a job like that and live comfortably, right?
Mm-hmm.
A house that has electricity and hot water, right?
Mm-hmm.
But does that really mean you're wealthy?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, again, for sure, which perpetrates the stereotype that, oh, you just go to the rest, you come back with an iPhone, only because you can pay it on contract.
Exactly what I was about to even say. Because when you guys land there, it's the latest iPhone, latest MacBook. So we just
you probably get it on contract and you can pay your $40 every month, you know, instead of paying the upfront $1,500. So we just, again, we all need to stop living a lie. And part of the lies that we need to stop appreciating is that, I mean, if you have the cash, blow it. I can't tell you. I mean, you can't tell people how to spend the money, but also just most people walk around with a pretty fancy accent, but a very empty wallet. Because the accent buys you status.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to acknowledge that. Yeah, you know, I'm kind of struggling. Who does that, you know?
Yeah. And how would you even start telling people how? But even with struggling, is it very easy, even as I was talking about, for you guys to acknowledge that you're struggling? Being international students, obviously with our own prejudices, thinking you guys are wealthy. And again, obviously at times, like people who told you, don't go abroad, stay here for your undergrad, then go there later.
For your master.
Then you go there and start struggling. Would it be easy for you to still come out and say, I'm struggling, to let people be like, yeah, we told her so, or whatever?
I personally go out of my way to talk about some of the struggle that I face all the time. I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's so important that we start talking about these things because people can die. Like, the stress can be so much to the point that people can die.
Yeah.
That's the reason why we need to start talking about it and start being more open about the kinds of struggles we face. I can never say that I had a breeze in college. Never.
Really?
I can never say that. I had that. Not horrible. It was incredibly stressful. There's so many things. After going into grad school, there's so many things I did not know. Like, I didn't even know how to speak up for myself with my supervisor. I didn't know what to look for in a supervisor. I did not even begin to know how to write a proposal for a thesis for a one-year-long master's program. I had to figure all of that out. I didn't know where I was going to get my money for graduate school. Like, who's going to pay my tuition? It's not like my parents are wealthy enough to afford their seven million.
Uh-huh.
Impossible. No. I mean, the worst they could raise is one or two. So it's important to continually talk about it. Do I do it? I try to do it. Does it need to happen more? 100%. Because all of us are struggling in some way, shape, or form. And also generally just integrating into, you're in a new culture. New people, you're not surrounded by the initial support systems that you're surrounded with. You don't have the initial support systems of, oh, I'm having a bad day, let me just go home.
Exactly.
You don't have that. You don't have somebody to just bring you food when you're having a rough time. When we were kicked out of college, during COVID, they told us we can't even stay at school. I was like, where can I even go? I was staying with my friend in Cornell. I have an aunt in Maryland. Pretty privileged again. I mean, I can always go there. But I'm thinking, for somebody who does not have anybody, where do you go? Where do you even begin?
That time flights are over the roof or are fully booked.
Mm-hmm. So here your school is like, you need to exit. So every international student goes through some struggle of integrating, of making friends. Very few people just have a breeze making friends. It's incredibly difficult to make friends. Make friends, to socially integrate, to have a life, like just have a life and feel like you're connected and feel like you're a whole human being.
Yeah.
It's yeah. So I think it's not happening enough. Do we try to talk about it? I do, and the circles around me do, but we need to do a lot more. A lot more, because everybody just thinks everybody has figured it out. Nobody has figured it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're signed to start a podcast.
Honestly.
You're signed to start a podcast.
Yeah.
Because as even as you said, even as I saw that exactly I signed to this morning saying someone just writing how they'd rather suffer in Kenya, where if things went haywire and the worst case scenario, they'll take a matatu to 50 bob back to their rural place to their mother and try reset.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That side of the world, I mean,
where do you even begin?
Crazy. Yeah.
It's crazy. But also, let's also acknowledge the amount of opportunities and privilege that it offers you.
Yeah, true.
If for instance, just global exposure, research, you can work hard, apply to companies, get internships, you can travel abroad, you learn how to pick your classes early enough, you learn how to be eloquent. It comes with all of these things. But does that still make it easy? No.
No.
Mm. No. This whole of, oh yeah, you'll just go there and all of a sudden you figured your whole life out. No.
It is.
No. But you just
as once you've entered MIT, you are assured of success. Come rain.
You're not. Actually, you still even apply to things. Me, I used to think that, oh, me, I got into MIT. I'm all set for life. Impossible.
Rules really?
Yeah, you still
have jobs are not knocking at your door. I thought that was the
way. Jobs
looking for you.
Okay, they do come looking for you, but you still interview and you can get rejected.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten rejected for when I was applying to my job. I applied to over 200 jobs before I got one. Yeah. I don't think you handed things on a silver platter. Of course, the name.
You aren't like you know in Kenya. You're told. Once you go to such schools, you are assured. So even though you go to an interview, it'll be like, once they see MIT, it's a lie.
I mean, it's a lie. Of course, again, it opens some doors for you because of your alumni network, because of it does. So
yes.
That one has acknowledged that there are opportunities. Like you'd have companies come to your school for a career fair, of course. You'd get an interview, yeah. But does that guarantee you the job? No.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're also still competing with all of the others at MIT still. And you have like also similar schools, same caliber, same candidate base. And they don't just recruit from only big schools. They recruit from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
So again, dispel that myth of, okay, now what, see, there's no time in your life and you're okay. Of course, there's some privileges that come with the name. But that doesn't necessarily mean, oh yeah. All set for life. No.
Like everything will be handed in a silver platter. Just reach there and lazy.
Even in those study abroad programs, you realize people have to apply. You have to apply, go through an interview process and be accepted. And you can get rejected.
And again, ironically, even yesterday I was talking to my brother was telling me about this because he's planning to come there as well. But he was telling me about you know, now a lot of guys who we know who've gone abroad always talk about they had doing internship during the summer. And so automatically, since a lot of guys are saying they're doing internships, you think that getting these internships are very easy, like it's an automatic thing. But you're telling me, but qua ground, it's actually not as easy. These guys who actually get these internships have put in the work.
I told you, see, I've made 250 job applications. one job. Do people even talk about how it takes a lot of work, honestly? Just people
don't know.
No, and also again, I think I don't know where that associating yourself, not talking about the struggle, creates some form of social status of I'm doing well. Why do we not acknowledge the weaknesses in the name of I'm just like it doesn't take away from your doing wellness. If you just talk about your struggle, you know, you can still do well and still struggle.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah. That's actually a very interesting thing. I think guys feel like probably if they talk about their struggle, you see them as weak.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
Yeah.
But really, the struggle is part of the process at the end of the day. So why don't we make it something that's normal? Failure is part of it, you know? Like, how many people would actually come and say, I've applied to 250, I did 250 applications and only got one job. Everyone wants to say, hey, I just applied to 10 and like 5 accepted me. And so,
yeah, it's just, no, it doesn't work like that. It does not work like that. Like, I wish it worked like that, honestly. I really wish it did.
But it, yeah,
we work incredibly hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I don't think we talk about that enough.
So, even as we talk about this, now tell me about how we finished high school and left your medicine dream. We're not circling back.
Bro. So, I finished high school, Billy, and I thought I was going to be a doctor. Like, I really believed all my life, I just thought I was going to be a doctor, I was going to help people. I'd even started working at or volunteering at that referral hospital when before I even was accepted. But I missed medicine. So I was called to engineering school, actually, in Moi. But Uzuri, I did a faculty transfer into medical school, and it worked. Faculty transfer. Ideally, I wanted to have done medicine in Nairobi. I mean, who doesn't want to have done medicine in your N?
Yes.
Everybody wants that. But I when I finished Form 4, my cutoff points were not enough for medicine in Nairobi. So I just felt like everybody asks me, why did I start this whole US thing? I just felt like the world had bigger things to offer me. That's the only reason. I really just felt like the world had bigger things to offer me. So I ran into this program called Education and Social Empowerment Program. It's like ESEP or CANSAP. I think you've
They should sponsor this episode. Carry on.
Ah, they're an NGO. Pay them their sponsored. So, so I went to that program and started this whole, they teach you how to do the SATs, they help you with your essays, they teach you about which schools are good based off of the culture of the school and your personality, blah, blah, blah. And then so I applied. When I was applying, I didn't even think I would ever get into MIT. I wanted to go to Stanford or Columbia because when I thought about Columbia, I was just like, oh my God, you know, young and in love in New York City.
The city that then sleep.
It's just like, you know, I'm going to be a city girl. I'm going to be in the streets of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
But both Stanford and Columbia rejected me, and MIT accepted me. I actually just put in an application because my program director had said, oh, you know, they're trying to get more women into MIT. Maybe you should apply. And then I got in. I was pretty lucky.
Is it lucky, really?
I don't know. Uh-huh. Let me just say, it was not what I had planned. Like, I really don't. MIT was not it. It was not that I had thought about. It was not even my dream school.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So that's the story. I got to.
You get to MIT,
I did
talk to me a bit more about that feeling of you felt like the world had more to offer.
I just knew if I stayed, Billy, I just knew if I stayed, what would have happened to me. I knew I was going to go to Moi. I was born and raised in Eldoret. Like, I went to primary school right next to my high school. And then I went to college. I would have gone to college right next to my high school. My whole life would have been in Eldoret, number one. What would have happened to me after I graduated? I would have probably maybe moved to Nairobi. I would have met a doctor, another doctor, who would probably move in together. Everybody would be happy for us. We would, you know, live in a one-bedroom, and then all of a sudden we're living in a three-bedroom, and then, like, I would be probably a middle-class home, and then, you know, he probably would want to go back to his master's, you know, and then I have, like, one or two. Like, I knew that was going to be my life. And I thought about what doctor, would that be a bad life? No, not really. I just felt like there was more things, though.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt like, I don't know, I cannot explain it. I just felt like, gosh, this cannot be it.
Yeah, this can't be it.
Yeah, it couldn't have been. Did I really, really? Okay, so one thing I'm a strong believer in is asking the universe for things. Always ask the universe for things, and it will give it to you. If you work hard and if you're, you know, if the energies align, you'll get it. What is yours is yours. So did I really know what I was asking the universe for when I was like, oh my God, I want bigger things for my life? No, I didn't. I don't think I fully comprehended what I was asking for. When I was in high school, I used to have a friend called Julie. And me and Julie, we had jacaranda trees in my house. And sometimes during preps, because I was a prefect, I could be late. I would go, we would sit behind the jacaranda trees and lay on the, sometimes the flowers would fall, would carpet the ground, and it would look very beautiful, purple. And would sit, lie on the grass and look at the sky and just be like, truly, wouldn't it be so nice to just be flying around the world? In high school, I did that. Did I really, really know what I was asking? No. Is that kind of coming to life? Yeah. Very crazily. So the story was just, this cannot be it. Yeah, simple as that.
So as you go into MIT, tell me about it.
I got into MIT my first year. A huge culture shock.
So here's where the culture shock happens. Not in high school, but here.
Oh, huge culture shock when I got to MIT. My first semester, MIT put us up in a hotel because my dorm had flooded. Put us up in a hotel. The hotel had a phenomenal view of the Boston skyline. And I remember when my host dad was taking me to the hotel, I didn't even know how to open the door.
Really?
I didn't know, because of the key card. You have to tap a key card. Me thought you have to insert it somewhere like an ATM. So many things I didn't know. I started navigating. We had a shuttle. The hotel allowed us to use the shuttle to navigate around town. I didn't know that. I didn't know so many things, though. Also, to the affordable places to be buying things like bedding, blah, blah, blah. So it was again culture shock. So that's how I started. My community was mostly international students and then some Kenyans who were there at the time. I went in wanting to study mechanical engineering, but I started taking classes in computer science and I liked it. And then I just decided to run with it. Yeah, until I graduated.
And after graduation, even before I get to after graduation, talk to me a bit about MIT in its fullness. Is it as difficult as a lot of us think about it? Is it really the best university, or is it very overrated?
Of course, it's the best university. Let's get that straight.
Okay, you'd obviously say that. I don't even know I asked.
Computed, hello. I mean, You have to align your priorities right now, because I'm your guest in the podcast. You have to be like, all hail MIT, you know?
Mimi, where you went, sina haki. I can't even talk bad about any university.
No, so I can't really say that it's the best or not. I don't know, because that's the only reference point I have. Do I feel like there are other schools that could
you have had Moi?
Oh, okay, yeah, it was the Think about colleges in the US. What was I saying? I was saying, was it hard? Incredibly difficult. Incredibly. I do not think I've ever gone through the amount of stress and duress that I went through any time in my life.
Worse than KCC's pressure and all that.
If you think about KCC's pressure, but going through that every week, every single week.
Not end of years, not week.
We have homework every week for every class that you take. You have exams every 4 weeks. by the time you're in the fifth week, we had this thing called a fifth week red flag, which was you're already told if you're going to fail the class or not, or whether you need to rethink your decision. And
fifth week.
Yeah, and you have to also think about every class, at least for computer science, every homework is designed to take you at least 10 hours outside of classwork.
Weekly?
Yes. On average. You're taking to make computer science classes, computer science and math classes. So you have at least 30 hours of work.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of class, and that's you on top of your class load, which would take you like what 20 hours. That's already 50 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And because also I never coded or taken at a computer science in high school. I didn't do that. Me was starting from scratch. Your homework, yeah, and you're in school with people who have trained all their lives to go to MIT.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you're 10 hours in and take 20. Mimi, I feel like I really struggled in college, bro.
It was that bad. Were you crying every day?
Okay, not crying every day, but you can't cry every day because there's no time to cry, Billy. Really, yeah.
Time was the issue.
How much did you find? No, you set a 5-minute cry break and you cry for 5 minutes. And 5 minutes, Ikisha, you get back into it. All the time. That was actually my coping strategy. Just, yeah.
And no support system at this time. No one to tell you how to do
you have your things. Friends. You have your friends. You have also other students who you came with. But the support systems, I don't feel like were enough when I was in school. Or maybe I didn't know how to leverage them well.
Mm-hmm.
Like my advisor was a part of my life, but didn't significantly affect my life. I saw advisors who would advise you things like which classes to take with which professor at which time of the year, because some classes are offered in the fall and in the spring with different teachers, and different teachers give you different experiences when you take the class. So there's so many things. I don't feel like I had the right support. So many things you don't know about navigating school, like you can get mentorship on what fellowships to apply for, or people to teach you things. Like, you have to build rapport with your professors early if you're thinking about going to graduate school, because you need to get a project and you need to get somebody who can, you know, you can do work with.
Yeah.
So I don't, but also I feel like part of it was the school. But my college experience, I don't think was typical also. It could have been for again, me, I'm not the typical MIT student. I don't feel like I'm the typical MIT student.
Tell me what the typical MIT student is and who you are.
I feel like the typical MIT student first is white.
Amazing. That's the first point.
Yeah. Like white and from middle class background, and you know, yeah, not me.
Don't believe. Mm-hmm. And has been studying for MIT their whole life.
Mm-hmm. Probably. I just said, yeah, there are not too many international students. Yeah, I also don't feel like I belonged fully when I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because again, I felt like I had so many, I had diverse interests. And I was interested in things like research in sub-Saharan Africa, but there wasn't a lot of work going on on that front. I was also interested in non-technical work and non-technical courses, but it's a technical school, so the curriculum is very tech-heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't necessarily hone in on all of my other strengths.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's kind of my life at MIT, in summary.
So those are the things that made you super stressed. Did you ever go for therapy? At least try to deal with this. Uh-huh.
Yeah, 100%. Made it therapy. I'm a strong believer in therapy. Did therapy through almost all of college, even now. Every day. Therapy is important. If you're privileged enough to be able to do it, do it.
So So in short, as you're saying, therapy die and stop. There's no point you'll be like, okay, I no longer need therapy. Like, for you, what does therapy do for you? And is therapy the stereotypic way just for people who have been diagnosed with probably mental illnesses? Or therapy can be even about just your job, even just about...
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It can just be about how you're processing your emotions. It can just be about how you're thinking about things. Everybody has some work to do, psychological work to do on themselves. And the thing is, we're never taught about how our brains work and how our emotions work. Like, if that was something that we were taught in school, on top of your social support systems, you'd be okay to think about yourself. But you're walking on autopilot almost all of the times without really thinking about it. You don't really think about how you make decisions, don't really think about your emotional responses. You don't really, until you hurt people, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so did you learn all this in,
me, I joined therapy because I was feeling like my brain is sabotaging my body when I was in college. And I'm just like, why do I feel incredibly sad all the time? But also, again, being in a high-stress environment for an extended period of time just needed me to have somebody to give me perspectives. To the point where you lose sleep because, again, you're thinking, oh, my God, I'm so anxious. What's going to happen in the test tomorrow? Or utter blacking out in tests. I blacked out in tests so many times.
Really?
Yeah. That had never happened to me until I got to college. There's even, I don't even know if this is TMI, but even your menstrual cycle is psychologically affected by the stress. It's irregular because...
Hey!
Yeah. It's irregular. Uh-huh. But I started therapy because I was just like, I need somebody to help me understand my brain better so that I can influence my brain to influence my body to get through the emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's just like, there's no way I can come this far and die.
But that's crazy. Did you ever get anyone to trauma bond with about all that?
Yeah. What do you mean trauma bond?
Someone who was going through the same thing and just decide, influence each other and talk about these things.
There's actually a term, trauma bonding, like when you are addicted to trauma, like you just like you've not done work on yourself and you just keep redoing the same thing, same toxic traits. Thank you. Anyway, separate conversation. So I was like, did I trauma bond really? It's actually usually in the context of romantic relationships. I have amazing friends. So incredibly grateful for my friends. They really got me through college. Yeah, so I was always bonding with my friend Vivian, my other friends in other colleges. Yeah. It really got me to college. There are days even when I needed people to come and visit me to pull me out of the trance. Like, you're in a trance. You're just so stressed. You can't get yourself to do things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what is to cause the blacking out during exams?
You just get into a test and all of a sudden you don't remember anything. Yeah, it happens.
So what happens in that situation?
See, you get a zero.
No way.
You do.
No way.
So me, what I used to do, for some classes you would, you could resubmit for partial credit. Like you can do a resubmission for maybe 50%. Whatever you'd get.
Mm-hmm.
Not as bad as zero, right?
Yeah.
Because there's so many things that go into your grade, not just your tests. You have you have class participation. Blacking out, you just walk into a test and you forget. You're not all of a sudden you don't remember.
And it's like, then your brain just refuses at all.
And you know, when you leave the test and you're more relaxed a bit or you've had some sleep, you remember.
Damn. That's so crazy.
Happens. It's crazy. See, I'm telling you, to the point that your periods are irregular.
Hey, that therapist. I hope you're taking her out on dates to just tell her. Wow. Thank you.
But yeah, that's... Yeah. But also, I have to acknowledge... I have to acknowledge that even though it was stressful, I don't feel like I could do anything. Like, I wouldn't take a different route given another chance. No.
So you don't feel like you'd have taken a different course, maybe a less intense uni.
Course maybe, but would I still go to MIT? Yeah.
Really? You didn't decide to go to the Columbia and be a city girl?
Yeah, that's if I went. That's if they accepted me, you know? But like, could I do this all over again? Yep. Like if I, for instance, if I was had the option right now to choose between Kenya and US, would I still do US? Yep.
Yep.
I would still do it.
If I ask you this question, in the moment you're experiencing all these things, would that still be your answer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because again, okay, ask me again. But the nini is already over. I wish you met me in college. But yeah. I would still do it again. Like I think I have an incredible work ethic because of that. Incredible.
Like no one can question your work. Like I can question anything, but not your work ethic.
My work ethic. Come these things like that. There's this grit that comes from that. Incredible. Mm-hmm. Like those are things in you. Also my bandwidth for pressure, insane. Mm-hmm. Hey. You have grown for almost 6 years. So I feel like did that damage me, kind of break me inside? Of course. Do I still feel like I would do it again? Yeah.
So in short, even as you're going through all these things, you are still feeling like the world had more to offer. Or are you just saying, is this what the world had to offer?
I feel like I'm just getting started.
Eh.
I really think I'm just getting started. Yeah. Uh-huh. I still think the world has... Imagine now, if I didn't think that I would be here, how much more now?
Yeah.
You know that I'm here. Mm-hmm. I never imagined that this would have ever been my reality.
Mm-hmm.
How much more I feel like it's limitless.
Yeah.
Me, I'm going to do, I told you I want to be a teacher. Again, separate conversation, another podcast.
I've been written that down. I want to ask you about teaching. Why would you love to be a teacher? I was talking to my friends about this. Some of my friends said they want to be lecturers. And for me, I'm like, why would you even think about that? But for them, at least from their school of thought, was along the lines of like being in a public university.
Yeah.
For them means that, for them, at least the reality is that the teachers have not taught them well. The teachers have missed classes. And so they've really missed out on a very crucial part of the university that they wish then happened to more students. So for them, that would be teachers, so they can give students that good experience of university, to be those lecturers who care about their students, those lecturers will get their students, etc. So for you, why would you want to be a lecturer or a teacher?
I want to be a teacher because there's very want to teach at a research facility or an institution in sub-Saharan Africa at some point in the future. Because I think that's going to be the biggest driver for change. In sub-Saharan Africa to the global scene. I think fundamentally our problem is education.
Yes.
We need to dismantle and rebuild our educational systems. And I feel like the primary school and high school problem somebody else will solve. I will solve the higher learning institution problem and research problem. I also think it's very important that Africans start preserving and creating and preserving their own knowledge. Like we don't study our music, we don't study our languages are dying, even as we think about things like natural language processing and how artificial intelligence models are now learning languages. How many of them can comprehensively understand African languages? No, why? Because we're not doing it ourselves. We don't. Our curriculum is not suited to serve our needs. We are still serving needs of the East and the West. We're still in this post-colonial phase where we are not really fully identified ourselves as Africans. All right. So I just think education is our biggest problem, and I just think that like my college experience completely changed my mind about how I view the world. Because of that, I just feel like that's such an incredible gift that I want to give to somebody else. Who do I want to teach? I want to teach African politica or African politics, which is an all-encompassing term for what Africa is, how the knowledge of Africa and Africans is constructed and reconstructed in the world and in the global scene, and how Africans and Africa can rebuild and reinvent itself. Mm-hmm. So there's politics of identity around who is an African, what does it mean to be an African, why is Africa the way it is today. I want to teach about that. I also want to teach, and when I say Africa, I mean sub-Saharan Africa. I also want to teach computer science and good research. Do good research, because we need to start. We don't publish, we don't preserve knowledge, and then somebody else will solve the manufacturing problem. Somebody else will solve the jobs problem. Somebody else will solve the leadership problem.
But you'll solve that problem.
The higher learning education problem, yeah. Yeah.
As I keep telling my listeners, I have top-tier guests. Wow. Imagine now being on the front row, witnessing all this happening, and one day I'll be telling guys, you know, she was on my podcast.
Yeah, I hope so.
You guys.
You know, I really hope so. This is really
as you cool. said, you've told the universe, right? So
yeah, the universe will be kind to me. Actually, we start doing the work. Hey, after I made Jack Ivy, after I put myself out there like this, I need to actually do the work. Hey,
let me start doing now the there's work. No option. Now it's on record.
Absolutely.
10 years from now, we'll be asking you, have you come back to sub-Saharan Africa?
Yeah, I should ask me about that. In 7 years. Let's reduce again in 7 years.
And even with that, seven as we wind up,
mm-hmm.
what would you love to tell the listeners about even going for their dreams, and for you, even I love how you've talked about the changes you want to effect with your exposure. I think one of the great assets is people's brains. And now that you said even dedicating your time to come back to sub-Saharan Africa when everyone else wants to build their own life, and you know, if it's not affecting me, then c'est la vie.
Mm-hmm.
So for you, what is something you want to tell someone who wants to go for their dreams? And what is something you tell little Christabel?
Bro, okay. Oh, these are really tough questions. What I would tell somebody who is thinking about going for their dreams is, first, starts with wanting big things for yourself. Like, there has to be a vision. There's no vision. There's no, like, it's impossible, difficult to build the mission. So it starts with building, wanting big things for yourself. Number two is, if you have to work tenaciously hard.
Mm-hmm.
Good things will come in one day or even 1 year or even 2 years. Good things. If you look at companies are built over 4 years, 5 years before you start seeing results. And most people usually give up because you don't see, you want results very quickly, but it just takes a different kind of grit and a different kind of tenacity to just keep at it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that one is just keep working hard. It always pans out if you keep working hard. You can't, don't give up. It's just, good things take a long time. What I would tell little Christabel, I just wish she believed in herself more, strangely.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really wish she believed. Like, if I could go back, I would give her a hug.
Mm-hmm.
Give her a hug and keep telling her, like, don't dim your lights, don't, you're not crazy. I'll tell her, just keep dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I'll tell her. First, I'll just give her a hug because I know she's been going through it. The met her in college, Kwanzaa, I would be like, bro, I feel you. Let's go eat ice cream first because in McDonald's, because I just like McDonald's fries. Here's like $2. I like them.
Uh-huh.
Her ice cream and McDonald's, and I'll just give her a hug and tell her, yes, just keep working. You're doing okay. I feel like if I worked a bit more hard and was a bit more tenacious, my outcomes would have been a bit more different. But I'm still glad about how things turned out. But if there's one thing I did, I feel like I was almost always giving up.
Mm.
Yeah. So that's it.
And what would you tell Christabel in this moment of her life?
What should I tell her in this moment? What should I tell myself in this moment of my life? Be patient with the process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. will tell myself to be patient with the process, because to be present and to just to hang in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I hope now she's enjoying life and overcompensating for how she didn't enjoy life in college. I just hope she's traveling the world.
I should. Not that I pesa to do. Wish I had money. As soon as I have money, nobody will ever see me. I'll just be traveling.
So that's why you're being patient with the process.
Patience with the process is just from work standpoint, from where I am in life, and I think some of the challenges I'm facing now need me to be just patient.
And are we expecting a doctorate from you anytime soon?
Doctorate? I punguza the pressure. Maybe not a doctorate. Maybe an MBA.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was pretty sure I wanted to do a doctorate at some point. Last year, maybe if you had asked me the same question, I'd be pitch positive. But after being in corporate industry for a while, maybe an MBA, not necessarily a doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I guess that is it. I think the listeners should tell us what they think about this episode. Christopher, you owe me several episodes. We have to talk about the corporate world.
Yeah, at this point, let me even I'll keep a running list. So I'll be waiting for, after 6 months, we do this again.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Please.
Yeah. Once you break the ice with your other guests.
Yes. Right. About decolonizing the mind, what change means. We have so many things. You need to go more in depth about higher learning.
Absolutely.
Why higher learning and not the high school? Why not primary?
Yeah.
So listen us, tweet us at the Busharian Pod, follow us at the Good, the Bad of Busharian on Instagram. Tell us what your thoughts are on this episode. Have a lovely week ahead, folks, and cheers.